Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
It cost more than $230 million to make Avatar and a paltry $11 million to make The Hurt Locker. Avatar showed in thousands of movie theaters across the country. The Hurt Locker was never playing on more than 500 or so at a time. And yet...
winning 6 Oscars.
The winner is The Hurt Locker.
And the winner is...
Paul N.J. Audison for The Hurt Locker.
And the winner is... The Hurt Locker.
Hurt Locker took home 6 golden statues, Avatar only 3. Seems like a clear victory there. But then again, The Hurt Locker has earned $21 million, while Avatar... about $2.5 billion so far, so maybe James Cameron is laughing all the way to the bank. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning and happy Monday. It is Monday, March 8th, and Miles O'Brien is here with me sitting in for John Hockenberry today. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning, Celeste. Let's check the morning's top news for you. They're counting votes in Iraq this morning, a day after millions went to the polls to choose a new parliament. Christopher Hill, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, tells CBS News this morning the election bodes well for both Baghdad and Washington.
This election is something on which we will base a new relationship with Iraq.
The U.S. hopes to reduce its forces in Iraq to 50,000 non-combat troops by September 1st. The first results from yesterday's elections are not expected for a few days.
In Afghanistan, plans are being drawn up for an offensive in the Taliban heartland of Kandahar. General Stanley McChrystal, the top NATO commander in Afghanistan, says it'll be different than the recent offensive in the city of Marja.
There won't be a D-Day that is climactic. It will be a rising tide of security as it comes.
Nearly 1 million people live in the city of Kandahar. This morning, Defense Secretary Robert Gates arrived in Afghanistan on an unannounced visit. Here at home, President Obama is taking his last-ditch push for health care reform on the road this morning. He'll be in Philadelphia, where he'll try to persuade the public to back his proposals. And a big night for the Hurt Locker, as we said at the Oscars. Best Picture, Best Director for Kathryn Bigelow. She was the first woman to win that award. And we're joined now by Melina Ryzik. She's the carpetbagger blogger for the New York Times. Melina, why has it taken so long for a woman to win Best Director?
That's a good question. Only a few other women have been nominated in the past, and I think it probably speaks to the system that Hollywood has in place. It's hard for anybody to get a movie made, and there's just not that many female filmmakers, or there haven't historically been until now.
Well, do you think that last night is a sign that the tide is turning for women in Hollywood?
I hope so. There's been a couple of other movies this year that were made by women, and Education, Moonsurfing was nominated for a couple of awards. So it does seem that things are changing, and Kathryn Bigelow talked about serving as a sort of inspiration to other filmmakers, female filmmakers. So I think that is what's going to happen.
So, Melina Ryzik, stay with us. We'll be back with you later this hour. An interesting tidbit, The Hurt Locker is the lowest grossing Best Picture in all of Oscar history.
Inflation adjusted, presumably.
I actually don't know that, but we won't assume. Looking at the markets, Asian markets are up. European indices are down. Futures are up. The Dow will start at 10,566. The S&P opens at 1,138 and the NASDAQ at 2,326. Coming up, we're starting a new series this week. What makes a genius?
Very similar to those Maybelline commercials. Maybe you're born with it, or maybe it's just make-believe.
That's a take from a listener, Jason, in Washington. That's great. We're going to talk more about genius later in the show. And we're asking you specifically about everyday geniuses. Do you know a genius in your life? Tell us about a genius that you know, and why do they deserve the label? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. Miles, any geniuses?
I can't think of anybody. Actually, the politically correct question, my wife. The politically correct one as well.
Not just politically correct. That's actually the honest truth. My significant other, very smart man. But, you know, my grandfather was the dean of African-American composers. So he's like the, you know, genius with a capital G, William Grant Still.
It's hard to live in that shadow, isn't it?
No, it's kind of great.
Oh, okay.
I love it.
You're grooving.
8778, my take. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee, joined this morning by Miles O'Brien, who is filling in for John Hockenberry. You know, we've all heard of Megan's Law that was named after the 7-year-old New Jersey girl who was raped and murdered in 1994. And then Jessica's Law that was named for another girl who suffered the same fate in 2005. And we're wondering how long it'll be before we get a Chelsea's Law. 17-year-old Chelsea King was allegedly raped and murdered by John Albert Gardner III. He's a registered sex offender in San Diego County. That happened last month. Gardner had been freed from prison after serving 5 years for molesting a 13-year-old girl in the year 2000. And in response, lots of people are calling for tougher laws and enforcement when it comes to sex offenders, and it sparked a national dialogue on how to deal with these kinds of criminals. Joining us now is Greer Weeks, Executive Director for PROTECT, a national organization lobbying Congress for more to be done when it comes to sex offenders. And Julie Brown, a senior staff writer for the Miami Herald. She's written about the dozens of convicted sex offenders who've set up an encampment under a bridge in Miami. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Greer, let's start with you. There's already a whole host of laws that were named after girls who have suffered terrible crimes at the hand of sex offenders. Do you feel that we don't have enough laws in place to protect children?
Well, as a lobbyist who works on nothing but child protection legislation, I can promise you these laws were never intended as a serious effort to protect children. It's a cynical business to exploit the death of a kid, but each of these laws you mentioned usually follows the same formula. You need a gimmick that the media will go for. It needs to sound tough, but it actually has to be cheaper than doing something meaningful because you want to get your bill passed. And we see this, cyclically. It's tragic, but the greatest obstacle that PROTECT faces as a pro-child anti-crime lobby is not that people are against protecting children, it's that they've been sold snake oil by politicians and cable news and self-appointed child advocates. So these are not typically serious laws at all.
Well, let me ask you, is there a higher rate of recidivism among sex offenders? Are they more likely to leave prison and offend again?
Well, that's usually a question that's asked to academics, and they're all across the spectrum. I think the real question that most of us want to know, need to be asking is this a risk we can afford to take? These are dangerous people. They've proven by their conduct that they're dangerous to children. So, we turn our back on them at our peril. But pushing sex offenders under bridges and this kind of foolishness is not going to make children safer.
Okay, well, Julie Brown, let's turn to you. You cover this for the Miami Herald, and you've actually interviewed a number of sex offenders who are now in the outskirts of society. Let's hear a clip from Michael Duggins. He's the brother of a sex offender.
Each one of these people done their time. They paid they time to society. They done everything. Not trying to justify anything that they did. They all know what they did was wrong in some kind of way. That's why they were sent to prison. But now you got sent to prison and you've done your time.
So, Julie, it sounds like he's making the argument that there's no reason to treat this crime any differently than any other.
Well, to some degree, that some of them do. But I also think that the issue here is, and it has come up in a couple of other states, that the crime of child offenses has different categories. I've spoken with a number of them who 20 years ago when they were 18 or 19, they had a girlfriend who was 14 or 15, and that was 20 years ago. They were in prison for a great number of years. They come out of prison, they want to start over, and they have this sort of red letter on their record, and they can't get a job. They can't live with their families. They have no support system to try to get to the point where they can go on with their lives. People argue that there has to be some other alternative than to put them. In Miami's case, there was as many as 100 of them that were living under a bridge. This particular rule made it so that they only had to live under the bridge at night. So during the day, they essentially could go out and walk in society. So that certainly wasn't protecting children.
Let me ask you, we actually spoke with Lauren Book Lim. She was abused for 10 years by her nanny before starting the group Lauren's Kids. That's an education and child advocacy group for abused children in Florida.
I know her very well.
Yeah. She spoke to the producers yesterday, and we asked her how she felt about balancing civil rights of the accused pedophiles with the safety of communities and children.
everybody is entitled to be free, be safe, they've served their time. I understand that. But I go back to an example of somebody who is doing drugs or alcohol. They spent their time in prison and they're out, and maybe they're in AA. They go to their meetings, but let's say they have an off day. They backslide with somebody does drugs. Who are they hurting? They're really hurting themselves. If a pedophile has a backslide, they don't go to counseling. They have a trigger that they don't address. Who are they hurting? A 3-year-old, a 5-year-old, a 10-year-old. That's just not acceptable to me or anybody who advocates for children.
Julie, what about that argument among people that this is a worse crime?
Well, it is. It's a terrible crime, and certainly for the worst predators. And, you know, they do certain evaluations of these people when they're in prison and before they leave prison. And there's a difference between a sex offender who's just on the internet looking at children and someone who actually goes around attacking children. The argument here is we do not, when a killer, for example, kills a child, we do not put them under bridges. We do not segregate them from society after they pay their time. Or when someone abuses a child in another way, which can be pretty horrific, we don't have these kinds of strong laws for them. That's not to say that we should sympathize more with child molesters, but I think that I think what people are arguing is that there may be a halfway here. There needs to be a balance.
Well, that's Julie Brown, senior staff writer for the Miami Herald. And Greer Weeks, let's go back to you. You're with the National Association to Protect Children, or PROTECT for short. What kind of laws do we need? What will work in terms of strengthening protection of kids?
Well, the most immediate thing here is that if you're going to let these people out who are sexually dangerous to children, then you need to actually keep them under close surveillance and restrictions. You know, putting them on a sex offender registry is somewhat of a fraud because they're not being monitored or restricted, and the way to do that is to keep them serving a court-ordered sentence of probation or parole. But that doesn't sound as good to the media, and won't get you as much coverage. We also, you know, have got to stop making monsters. You know, a 30-year-old child killer was a child just yesterday.
You have to be mindful they're still human beings, I guess. Greer Weeks is the executive director for the National Association to Protect Children. He joined us along with Julie Brown, who's a senior staff writer for the Miami Herald. Thanks to you both. And now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in on the top headlines.
President Obama heads to Philadelphia today to get public support for his health care reform plan. He's trying to build enough support to push the legislation through Congress without Republican support. The Department of Education is taking a deeper look at civil rights issues in the nation's schools. It's investigating whether students of both sexes and all races are getting equal access to college prep courses. Education Secretary Arne Duncan will tell us more in a speech in Alabama later today. In international news, there's been an earthquake in Turkey. The government says nearly 60 were killed when the quake struck in the east of the country. It happened at night as people were sleeping.
An opinion poll by our partner, the BBC, has found that a substantial majority of people believe access to the internet should be a fundamental human right. The poll questioned 27,000 adults around the world. In Japan, Mexico, and Russia, nearly 3 out of 4 respondents said they could not cope without web access. Here at home at the Oscars last night, a lot of first-timers went home with the golden statue. Catherine Bigelow took the directing Oscar for The Hurt Locker. It also won Best Picture, that film. And one of the movie stars, Anthony Mackie, explains his success, the movie success, on NBC's Today Show this morning.
And we transcended the idea of filmmaking. We transcended the idea of acting, and we made art.
In other words, Sandra Bullock won Best Actress for The Blind Side, and Jeff Bridges finally got his nod. He won Best Actor for Crazy Heart. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, healthcare. It's again on the top of the president's agenda. We're going to look at that with Todd Zwillick, our D.C.'s correspondent, in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
It's time now for some takeouts on stories we're following this morning. We're joined first by our Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick. Healthcare, again, on the president's front burner this week. He travels to Pennsylvania today. Todd, what's on the agenda?
Hi, good morning, Miles. The president is going to Glenside, Pennsylvania. That's just a few miles north of Philly, to Arcadia University. And what the president is doing today is following through on a pledge he made last week when he gave a speech on health care. He urged Congress to get this health care bill finally done in short order. He's given them yet another deadline, by the way. But then he said that he would go out and make the best case to the American public on this bill and the need for it. And that's important. And the reason why it's so important, Miles, is that this health care bill isn't that popular with the public. What the health care bill is trying to do appears to be popular, but the bill itself isn't. So the president has to go out and, again, try to use his rhetorical skills, try to use his salesman-in-chief skills to convince the public that this is an important bill to pass. He also has to convince people that the process that's being used, this reconciliation process, which is really some Senate arcana, to be honest, and has gotten into the public sphere, is also not new, is also not an abuse of power or an abuse of the rules, that it's really okay and that they're just using it to make tweaks to the bill, but that passing the bill is the most important thing. He has to make that case.
So any bill is better than no bill at all. Is that the thinking?
That's certainly been the president's message all along. Republicans, of course, say, well, we don't want no bill either. We just don't want this bill. And the public is on our side. And there are some data to back that up. What the nuance there is that when you break this bill up into its individual pieces, giving people insurance, making it so that your insurance company can't drop you, making it so that if you lose your job, you can still keep your coverage, that young people can keep their coverage, all of those things individually are very popular. But the public doesn't like some of the deals that went into making this bill. The public doesn't like the cost of this bill. So the president does have a significant sales job in Pennsylvania, a swing state, by the way, and that's no accident. He has a significant sales job to convince these people that this is the best possible route right now that they can take.
Well, take us inside the negotiations a little bit. I know Democrats are negotiating terms of the bill, and it could very well affect how much all of this might cost Americans. What's being proposed?
And that's really important. The first thing that's being proposed is for the House to pass the Senate bill. And that bill has already passed the Senate with 60 votes. But what they're then going to go back and try to do under this reconciliation process is do a lot of things that may make insurance more affordable for people. One thing, everybody under this bill will have to get insurance somehow. And they'll be getting it, many people who can't get insurance elsewhere, on the exchange. Well, there's going to be subsidies and tax credits. If you're a family that makes around $88,000 or $90,000, anything below that, you're going to be entitled to government money and subsidies that make insurance more easy for you to buy. If you're a senior who gets prescription drug care coverage through Medicare, if you have high costs, right now there's a huge gap of about $5,000, maybe even more, that Medicare doesn't even pay for. They want to close that down so that you don't lose those costs. That's a couple of important things on costs that they're trying to do. This all costs the taxpayers more money. So the other thing they have to do, Miles, is figure out how they're going to pay for it. If you're a guy or a family that makes over $250,000, they're talking about raising your Medicare taxes even more to pay for all this stuff. So most people get a benefit. If you're wealthy, you might pay even higher taxes.
Todd Zwillick in Washington, thank you very much.
Let's move on to sports with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. And Ibrahim, we're kind of gearing up for March Madness here, college basketball in full swing. And let's go to women's basketball first, because something happened that you predicted, actually. The UConn women's basketball team tied their own record yesterday.
Exactly. UConn won. They beat Syracuse. But the key thing is here is that they are now in the race to see who can have the most wins in college basketball history. And now they're chasing UCLA, the men's team from the 70s, teams that included Bill Walton and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. So they're stepping into true history right now.
And, you know, a lot of people are asking themselves at this point, what makes a winning college basketball program? How do coaches, what do we know about what works in terms of motivating players?
Well, I think it's also, in terms of motivation, just let's look at Tina Charles. We had talked about her last week where she broke the records in terms of scoring and rebounding for UConn. She had 34 points yesterday. That's the most she's ever had. At one point, she was outscoring Syracuse. But what's important is that the coach lets her be herself. He lets her develop herself in her own way. For example, right now she's an intern at a level 2 security, minimum security prison in Connecticut, where she mentors people about how they're going to transition from prison into the real world. I think what a coach has to do is that they have to let their players be themselves and go and follow their passions and their own interests, and then you'll get the best out of them on the court.
Okay, so but Syracuse, not only did the women's team lose to UConn, but the men's basketball team lost as well.
It was a shocking game, and we had asked the question, who was the team best equipped in the Big East to beat Syracuse? Well, the answer is Louisville. Louisville has beaten Syracuse twice this year, and they set themselves up. They were on the bubble. It wasn't sure if they were going to get into the NCAA tournament or not because of their record. They have 11 losses. But because they've beaten Syracuse, a number one ranked team, twice this year, they're definitely going to be in the tournament.
Is Syracuse going to keep it the men's basketball team? Will they keep their number one rank?
They may not keep their number one ranking, but they're probably going to get a number one seed going into the tournament.
Okay, so who are we watching as we head towards March Madness? Who should we fill in on our little office pool ranks?
Well, this is who you fill in right now. Cornell, which got into the won the Ivies this weekend.
Right.
East Tennessee State out of the Atlantic Sun Conference. Winthrop out of the Big South, and Murray State out of Ohio Valley. Those teams are all in the NCAA tournament now.
Okay, that's how to win the brackets. Just keep listening to Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our Takeaway Sports contributor. Thanks, Ibrahim. Coming up, if you missed last night's Oscars, we're going to have some of the highlights for you.
This is for everybody who works on a dream every day.
Works on a dream is in the movies. Lots of people dream about the movies. We're going to tell you about the Academy Awards in just a few minutes. And one thing we're talking about all this week, genius. Ibrahim, do you know a genius?
My older brother is definitely a genius.
Wow. Yeah. Just earned yourself some points in the family. Let us know. 877. I have a good answer for that, but we don't have time for it.
No,
I'll tell you in a minute. 877-8 my take, thetakeaway.org. Tell us who is the genius in your life.
Coming up, we'll talk about the highlights and the lowlights from Hollywood's big night. A recap of the Oscars in a few moments. Here are some of the news stories we're following 30 minutes after the hour. President Obama and his education secretary are on the road this morning. The president in Philadelphia trying to rally public support for his health care plans. And Arne Duncan will speak in Selma, Alabama later, outlining a new federal effort to enforce civil rights in schools. He'll also commemorate the 45th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, in which several hundred civil rights protesters were beaten by state troopers on Selma's Edmund Pettus Bridge. Moving now to Iraq, the top U.S. general there is calling the country's national election yesterday a success. General Ray Odierno tells CBS News this morning the U.S. is on its way to a pullout of combat troops by September 1st as planned.
We always will do assessments of the situation. As I look at it today, we think we're on track to be down to 50,000 and change our mission. We obviously have contingencies in place, and we'll take a look at that.
The first election results are expected in a few days.
A rare move from the International Monetary Fund yesterday. The agency is proposing a plan for the world's governments to pool together to raise money to adapt to climate change. And AIG announced this morning it'll sell its overseas life and health insurance unit for $15 billion to MetLife. It's part of the company's ongoing bid to repay billions that it received last year in government aid. Taking a look at the markets, they are now open. The Dow is up about 7.5 points. The NASDAQ is up about a point, and the S&P is up less than a point. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
The 82nd Academy Awards took place last night, in case you're under a rock. And here to tell us everything that happened is Milena Ryzik, who is the carpetbagger blogger for our partner, the New York Times. She was at the ceremony, and she's at a party still. She's still rocking on. We also have TV blogger Delana Dixon, who actually got some rest last night, watched it from New York City. I got to start with you, carpetbagger Milena, at the party. Where are you, and what stars are around you?
Well, I'm at the Vanity Fair party. Having a little bit of champagne. I'm very glad to be talking to you because it's given me an opportunity to sit down for the first time all night. There's still plenty of stars here. Mark Bigelow, who was a screenwriter of The Hurt Locker, is marching around with a couple of Oscars, and some of his cast members are here, and Jeff Bridges and Maggie Gyllenhaal. So the party's still rocking.
All right, I'm getting my vicarious thrill. I'm drinking coffee, you're drinking champagne. Let's talk about the big winners last night. You got to put Catherine Bigelow right at the top of the list, and women in general. There haven't been many women directors who have, well, this is a first, actually. Matter of fact, let's listen to her for just a moment.
And I'd just like to dedicate this to the women and men in the military who risk their lives on a daily basis in Iraq and Afghanistan and around the world, and may they come home safe.
All right, Malena, it was Catherine Bigelow versus her ex-husband, James Cameron. Was this a surprise?
It really wasn't. People have been predicting that she's going to win the Best Director Oscar for weeks. She really had an unusual level of support from even her competitors. You know, as I've been covering the awards circuit, I have heard from everybody, from Quentin, from Lee Daniels, from James Cameron was very open about the fact that he wanted her to win. So it really wasn't a surprise, but it was a well-deserved win.
All right, our TV blogger, Delana, watching it from New York. What did you think of the show?
Well, I thought it was really great. It was really fun to see Alec Baldwin and Steve Martin open the show. I think they did a great job. They had great chemistry at the beginning. They really played off of each other. And it was really obvious that they were having fun. Obviously, making a movie together really bonded them. And they did a great job. I thought their timing was really impeccable.
Really? Okay. I thought it was a little bit stilted, actually. You thought it worked.
I did. I liked it.
All right. Another big winner was Precious. Let's listen to a couple of podium speeches. First, we're going to hear from Jeffrey Fletcher, the screenwriter, and then we're going to hear from Monique.
I don't know what to say. This is for everybody who works on a dream every day. Precious boys and girls everywhere.
First, I would like to thank the Academy for showing that it can be about the performance and not the politics.
All right, carpetbagger and partygoer, Malena. It seemed like there was some real emotion there. Was it real?
I think so. I mean, Monique has won a slew of awards this season, but Jeffrey, it's pretty new for him, and he is a first-time screenwriter and has been struggling to be a screenwriter for a number of years, held a lot of temp jobs before he had success with this screenplay. So I'm sure that he was genuinely moved. And judging by the way that Monique, you know, the kind of stuff that she said in the press room, I think it was genuine for her as well, even as many awards as she's won as expected as this win was. She was also really funny, which is a side of her that we haven't seen much throughout the awards season, even though she is, in her other life, a comedian. So that was fun to see.
Yeah. When she talks about it being about the performance, not the politics, Delana, the TV blogger, I'm trying to make this very clear because of the Delana-Malena thing. Delana, what was she referring to?
Well, I think when you think of Monique being a TV host actually doing a sitcom show, a lot of people could say, oh, we're going to write off this performance. It's a comedian doing a drama. Why should we give her an award? And there was some controversy about this film of how it was being pushed. Oprah Winfrey, Tyler Perry coming out and saying, you know, go see this film. And people were saying, should they be behind it, pushing it so hard? So people didn't get caught up in the semantics. They watched the performance. It was an amazing performance, Monique. And they give her the award for it. And that's what she was speaking of.
All right. I guess you could say Avatar was kind of a loser last night, certainly when you consider the amount of money that was spent on it, the amount of hype. Let's listen, though. Tina Fey and Robert Downey Jr. had some fun with this whole notion of Avatar, which is to say, who needs real human being actors?
We writers dream of a future where actors are mostly computer generated and their performances can be adjusted by us on a laptop alone.
It's a collaboration.
All right, carpetbagger Malena, is that the trend in Hollywood, you think?
Hard to say. Certainly more and more movies are going to be made in 3D. You know, we've got tentpole releases like Alice in Wonderland coming out. But I think that actors are still unsure about it as a medium, and that's why you've seen James Cameron out there on the award circuit when he was, you know, campaigning for this movie, trying to really drum home the point that this is not just doing voiceover, that this is actually acting. And, you know, actors that did have experience with motion capture technology, which he used in the past, it was really a miserable experience. You know, you had all the stuff glued in your hair, was uncomfortable, you didn't really feel like you were performing in any way. So the barrier to convince actors is pretty high that this is, you know, going to be a fun thing for them to add to their roster of tools.
All right, final thought from our TV blogger, Delana Dixon. 10 movie nominees. Good, bad, and different. Will they repeat that?
I think they may. Even though the competition really was through Avatar, The Hurt Locker, and possibly Precious for Best Picture, but what it did do by having 10 films is make us aware of some of the smaller films that were out there, such as An Education and A Serious Man. And when it comes time to rent your DVD from Netflix, maybe you'll try one of those films you may have not heard of.
All right, Delana Dixon, our TV blogger in New York. Milena Rysik, carpetbagger blogger for The New York Times, enjoying some champagne at the Vanity Fair party. Thank you both, ladies. Enjoyed the conversation.
You can read a blog post from Delana about her Oscar party at thetakeaway.org. Just click on blog. And if you've got a take on the Oscars, tell us.
My name is Steve. I'm calling from Manhattan. The dispute between Disney and Cablevision inadvertently did viewers a favor because they didn't have to watch the truly awful opening dance sequence with Neil Patrick Harris that started the Academy Awards show. I almost turned it off then and there.
Reach us with your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or at the website thetakeaway.org. We've been talking about the Iraqi elections all this morning. The votes are being counted now. The first results are expected later this week. One of the key areas of voting in Iraq was the oil-rich region of Kurdistan in the north of the country. The BBC's Jim Moore is there, and we spoke with him earlier this morning. The region where Jim is did not experience a lot of violence during yesterday's election, and I asked him where he's stationed and why they didn't see any violence.
Well, I'm in Iraqi Kurdistan, which are the three provinces which are recognized by the rest of Iraq as an autonomous Kurdish area within a federal Iraq. And they've been running their own affairs up here since the early 90s, but they are part of Iraq and they're electing to the Iraqi parliament. So it was general elections here too, but without the kind of security threats that you get in the rest of Iraq, because the Kurdish area in general is much more peaceful. They have had occasional bombs and occasional very bad bombs, but it's very occasional. It's very much the exception rather than the rule. And it was a very, very relaxed and almost a kind of holiday atmosphere as the Kurds came out to vote on Sunday.
I've heard people refer to the Kurds as kingmakers there in Iraq. Why do they have so much influence?
It is, you're right, it's kind of slightly disproportionate because the Kurds are very cohesive. They have their own national agenda, and even if they have their own internal divisions at home, once they're in Baghdad, they are representing Kurdish causes and interests, so they tend to act as a cohesive bloc, even if they have their own, as I say, differences on issues back home. So that means that they have something like 20-25% of the seats in the Baghdad parliament. If they add those seats to the big Shiite coalitions, especially if those two which have been running in these elections come together, that gives a two-thirds majority. So they have the kind of swing factor, and that's why they are regarded as kingmakers, because they effectively have the power to veto prime ministers by saying, nope, we're not going to join your coalition, and so the coalition doesn't happen.
United we stand kind of concept, I guess. Well, let's hear from an Iraqi themselves, Mazen Ishaker. He's an Iraqi-American. He returned to Iraq not long after the fall of Saddam Hussein. And he told the BBC why the voting in Iraq was so important to him.
As Iraqis, we're learning democracy, and I think we're doing quite well. We know democracy is the only way to go to make all these different nations, all these different religions and races live together under one flag.
Well, you know, from this side of the ocean, looking at all the violence leading up to the Iraqi elections, that vision of a united Iraq seems strange, unattainable. What do you think? Is it realistic for him to imagine a united Iraq?
It is kind of, it does sound slightly bizarre in the current circumstances, but no, Iraq is holding together, however loose it may seem at times, and the Kurds up here in the north obviously have their own agenda. Ultimately, they would like to be completely independent, but for the moment, they're working with United Federal Iraq. They would quite like to see the Shiites doing the same thing in the south of the country, but a lot of people are convinced that's the only way for Iraq actually to hang together, because it is a patchwork country, and a kind of loose federal arrangement may be the best way of stopping it from breaking up altogether.
That was Jim Muir, correspondent for our partner, the BBC. We spoke to him earlier about the Iraqi elections held over the weekend. The results are expected sometime this week. And the BBC actually has an online experiment going on right now that requires your help. They're wondering, what's the one thing in your life that you want the world to know about? The BBC is running a competition called My World. It asks for a 2-minute film of your perspective on the world. You can get the rules and find out how to enter by visiting our website, thetakeaway.org. Click on blog. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee, and here with me is Miles O'Brien, who is filling in for John Hockenberry today.
Good morning.
We have a new series starting this week. What makes a genius? Are there just a few people throughout history who are true geniuses, and the rest of us are just average forever? We're going to talk about that in a few moments, but we're also asking you about everyday geniuses. Tell us about a genius that you know and why they deserve the label.
This is the genius from New York City calling. I am the only genius that I know. For example, we all know that E equals MC square, but did you know that MC square equals E? I bet you didn't know that.
That is just a shocking revelation. Thank you. 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can post to our site, thetakeaway.org. More about geniuses after a check on headlines at 47 minutes after the hour. President Obama is heading to Philadelphia today to drum up support for his health care reform plan. He's trying to build enough support to push the legislation through Congress without Republican votes. Also today, the president is expected to appoint General Robert Harding to lead the Transportation Security Administration. Harding is a former senior Army official. He has extensive intelligence background. The TSA has been without a leader since President Obama took office. And in Turkey this morning, rescuers are searching the rubble for survivors after a 6.6 magnitude earthquake in the eastern part of the country hit last night. More than 60 are dead at this time. The Greek prime minister comes to Washington today. He'll meet with Hillary Clinton and then the president tomorrow. That's after days of meetings with European leaders, where he's been looking for support for the debt-ridden Greek economy. So the big question is, why is the Greek prime minister coming to America right now? To answer that, we spoke earlier with the BBC economics correspondent Andrew Walker. I asked Andrew if the prime minister's visit might be to ask for aid.
Not directly, no. And I think he's got a couple of things in mind. One is that there's at the back of his mind the possibility that Greece might want to borrow money to help it in this crisis from the IMF. Now, if that were to be the case, it would need the support of the US Treasury, so he might be raising that possibility. And bear in mind that also by raising this idea of the IMF, he's also putting a little bit of extra pressure on the other Europeans to come to his aid, because they really don't want the IMF coming in to publicly sort out a problem they couldn't fix themselves. And another thing I think he perhaps may be looking for in the United States is some sort of support for his concerns about speculation in the financial markets. I think he certainly feels that that speculators, people betting, as it were, against the possibility of a Greek default, have aggravated his problems, made it much more difficult than it need to be for Greece to borrow money in the financial markets. Having said all that, though, I think the really important visits were the ones he already made in the last couple of days to President Sarkozy of France and to Chancellor Merkel in Germany.
Andrew Walker is the economics correspondent for our partner, the BBC. He joined us earlier to talk about the Greek prime minister's visit to Washington.
In Los Angeles, it was a big night for first-timers at the Oscars. A lot of them went home with golden statuettes. Jeff Bridges finally won Best Actor for Crazy Heart. Here he is accepting the award.
Mom and Dad, yeah, look! Thank you, Mom and Dad, for turning me on to such a groovy profession.
Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Super genius.
What is genius?
Putting a man on the moon or inventing the internet.
I got a lot of PhD types and smart people around me.
The genius.
A stroke of genius.
Of the crowd.
A true musical genius.
Nature versus nurture.
The way he plays the game, he's just a genius out there in the court.
The American dream is to be able to make a living with what you are a genius at.
When you hear the word genius, who do you think of? Einstein, probably. Mozart, certainly. Da Vinci, maybe. Edison. Maybe you think of your own child as a genius, but we're wondering if kids are born as geniuses, is it a sort of gift from God, or is it something that actually develops? And here's a question that's important to all of us. Are there just a few geniuses in the world and throughout history, and the rest of us are kind of doomed to be average? David Shank says no. He's the author of the new book, The Genius in All of Us, Why Everything You've Been Told About Genetics, Talent, and IQ is Wrong. And David Shank is here to explain that to us. David, we've all gone to school. We've learned about how genes work, right? We all learned the Mendel experiments with the plants.
Yes.
And
yes.
How you have inherited traits. And isn't smartness an inherited trait?
Well, I've got some really good news. The sad part is that we, the public, are really still laboring under a 19th century idea of genes. We're still, it's very understandable that we all think this, because this is how we're taught, this is how we've been taught in school, that Mendel discovered genes by, you know, doing these pea plant experiments. And it's true, that story is true. But what scientists have now understood in the century and a half since then is that genes are not robot actors that have this blueprint information that specifies exactly what you are supposed to be as you grew up. In fact, genes are dynamic. Genes interact with the world around us. So the great news about genes and about our own human potential is that we are not doomed to mediocrity by our genes. We all of us have the potential for greatness if we can muster the resources to get there.
That's also bad news if your parents are really smart and you were hoping that was going to carry you through college, right? We spoke with Betty Hart. She's a researcher that you actually mentioned in your book. She was trying to figure out what happened in the years before preschool that made some kids better prepared for school.
We observed for an hour a day and recorded all the talk that went on. Some parents talk very little to the kids. Some parents talk huge, huge amounts, as you can see from the numbers.
You know, I talk too much, David, and you're saying from your research that that's probably good for my kid.
Talking is good. Any exposure of your kids to words,
woo-hoo,
reading or talking, and the more sophisticated the language, actually, that's also going to pay off. This was such an important study. What they found was over 4 years, the difference between the kids who were going to do well and the kids who were not going to do well is 32 million words spoken. Imagine. Over time, what that amounts to.
You're not just talking about genetics, and the book is fascinating in terms of how you talk about the way genetics behave, that they're not set before you're born, that they actually behave differently according to our environment. But the other thing you talked about was IQ and what we think we know about IQ. You spoke to a researcher named Jim Flynn, and here's what he was talking about, IQs for today's society as compared with years before.
IQ gains were moving at about 3 points a decade. Over 100 years, that would be 30 points, wouldn't it? And if our grandparents were 30 points below us, that would give them an IQ of 70. And 70 is the cutting line for mental retardation. And that hardly seemed to make any sense.
I agree. My grandparents were definitely not retarded. But what is he talking about here?
No, what he's talking about is this remarkable discovery that he made about 30 years ago that we're just only starting to grapple with now, that IQ has been improving every decade and every generation in us. And how could that be? Well, there is an obvious explanation that finally we realize is right in front of our noses. Culture improves IQ. And we're not talking just about national culture. We're talking about any culture. A family culture can improve IQ. Intelligence is not a thing that we are born with. Intelligence is a process, a cumulative gathering of skills that all of us can put together for our children.
I was kind of hanging on the fact that my IQ was probably higher than Mozart's. I was thinking that was in my favor. So that's probably not true.
Mozart became Mozart through a very orderly and interesting process, which I actually talk about in my book.
You do talk about your book. And let's touch on that just a second, because this is kind of the heart of your book. Mozart was part of a very strong family unit, and his dad had very high expectations from him from the beginning. And he interacted not just with his father, but his sister. But this was a family that really did things together and talked to each other.
They did, and Mozart was a younger sibling of an already advancing musician, his sister Nannerl. His father had made it his life's work to learn how to teach kids, and started teaching Mozart music from the very, very beginning. And another key fact about Mozart that people don't understand is, yes, he was composing early in quotations, but basically he was just copying other people's works. It took him many decades to produce the wonderful work that we now associate with
Mozart.
Which
is original.
That's right, right.
And, you know, the other thing that you touch on here, which is a message for my son, if he's listening, which is that the age-old adage, the way you get to Carnegie Hall is...
Practice, practice, practice. I hate to say it, but it's true.
So Ted Williams, genius because he hit a lot of balls. Mozart played a lot of piano, and Einstein probably did a lot of math.
And Michael Jordan and Yo-Yo Ma and all the people we think of as great got there through a very, very rigorous process. Not to say that we're all born exactly equal. We all have different advantages, including genetic advantages and disadvantages. But it's all about process.
David Shank is the author of The Genius in All of Us. Thanks, David. Visit our website. You can read an excerpt from the book and see audio examples of genius throughout history. You can also send us your questions on the site, thetakeaway.org. David will be answering those questions all week. Tomorrow we'll talk to a real live genius for some perspective on what it takes to become truly great. Her name is Sarah Chang, concert violinist who picked up at the violin at the age of 4. This is what she sounded like. This is her playing at age 9. Yeah, I was doing that at age 9. Talk to more about genius all this week. I'm Celeste Headlee.
That's genius. I'm Miles O'Brien, in for John Hockenberry.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.